Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Their Little Secrets by Vanessa Garbin, narrated by Lauren Irwin. Prologue. She really hadn't thought things through when she responded to the direct message.
"Do you want to be my sugar baby?"
he'd asked. They'd only been chatting for a few minutes. It was exciting at first. After she responded to the stranger with a vague maybe, she allowed her imagination to take flight. She pictured herself jetting across the globe, staying at luxurious five-star hotels, draping herself in designer gowns, glittering jewels dripping from her ears. She'd show her jerk of a boyfriend, Flynn. She'd show Sophie, her workmate, the girl Flynn had cheated on her with. She'd show everyone. No more making burgers and fries in a grease-coated kitchen 7 days a week. She finally had a first-class boarding pass out of her shitty life. But now, sitting on the edge of a motel bed in a room that smells stale and strange, she's starting to regret it all. Her entire body feels sticky and dirty in this cheap environment. Not that she is a princess or anything. She has lived her entire life in government housing. But she and her family, and most of their neighbours, are proud people and keep their homes clean and tidy. She wishes she could be home right now, folding laundry with her mother, something she usually complains about.
"Put this on,"
orders the man, who is yet to call her by her name or even meet her eyes. He's a lot older than her, double her age, she guesses, so maybe 40. Or he could be just an old-looking 30-something. He has a bland face and rubbery-looking skin with balding pale hair. His suit is expensive and fits well, she thinks, as she takes the dress from his outstretched hand. He smells good. Rich. Maybe this will work out. He could be testing her first, in this dump, before they move on to more lavish surroundings. She forces a smile, but he's too busy on his phone to notice, so she takes the satin dress and the wasted smile and shuts herself in the bathroom to get changed. The dress fits well, highlighting and exaggerating her curves, but also flattering her narrow waist. She starts to feel more confident, happier even, until she spies a stain on the dress just below her right hip. A whitish smear, like dried glue. Her stomach turns. She knows what that stain is. Now she is repulsed, her skin crawling. Who knows how many other girls wore this thing before her? She wants to take it off and tell the man that she's changed her mind, that she doesn't want to do this anymore. She stares at herself in the mirror, at her long brown hair cascading over her shoulders, at her dark Bambi eyes, and nods her head. She can do better. So much better than this bland, rude man. There must be websites where she can find herself a proper daddy, a gentleman who knows how to treat his baby. But something warns her, a primitive instinct deep in the base of her gut, that this man is dangerous. She decides to keep the dirty dress on and to do whatever it is she has to do in order to get the hell out of this room. It'll be good practice anyway. She'll have to get used to sleeping with men that repulse her. She steps out of the bathroom. The man looks at her breasts, and then his eyes drop to her hips. He nods. His face is red and coated with sweat. Her skin crawls. She can't help but shudder with disgust. The man notices. His expression grows dark and menacing, and his eyes narrow. It turns her blood to ice, and her skin breaks out in goosebumps. How can this be the same man she chatted with online? He seemed so friendly, so flirtatious and sexy.
"Now, take it off and lie face down on the bed."
She does as she is told, and while she lies there breathing through her mouth because the bed cover reeks of something unpleasant, she thinks of her younger brother and her older sister, of her parents, and of how much she loves them. Then she thinks of her cheating boyfriend Flynn, and wonders if he's thinking of her. He is the last thought running through her mind, before she feels a searing pain, so shocking that her world turns black. 1. Sara. It's unusual for my husband to be home for dinner. For the past few months, he has been staying back at work. He normally arrives sometime after 9 p.m, and by then I've already eaten.
Do you like the flowers, Sara?
Edward asks, his green eyes gleaming with self-pride.
See those yellow ones buried in the greenery there? The most expensive bloom in the shop. The florist explained to me how rare they are right now. Primrose lilacs.
He pours himself another glass of red wine and tops up my untouched glass, then winks at me, his expression one of smugness. My husband should know by now that rare and expensive things don't do a thing for me. I can find just as much joy in admiring a pretty weed or the clouds in the sky, and it costs me absolutely nothing.
Yes, they are lovely, I say, eyeing the sweet-smelling flowers nestled in the floral arrangement Edward has placed in a crystal vase on the table.
Thank you, I say, cutting into my steak. It took me years to master the art of cooking expensive meat, and no matter how many times we have it for dinner, I always take great pleasure in the way my knife slices through it like butter. Edward doesn't touch his food. I know he's waiting to ask me something. The wine, the flowers, being home for dinner. He's setting me up to say yes to whatever it is that he wants.
So, my parents would like us to stay over for the weekend, he asks, before taking a huge gulp of wine.
He should take it easy on that. I've noticed how ruddy his cheeks are becoming. My fingers tighten around my cutlery.
That sounds nice, but I've been asking you for weeks to come with me to visit my mother, and you're always finding excuses. Now you suddenly have time for a whole weekend away with your parents.
Edward's face drops, and he turns his head for a moment, but I can still see him roll his eyes.
Your mother lives in a one-bedroom apartment. I can't sleep on a fold-out couch. I've been brought up in king-size beds my whole life, Sara.
I'm tempted to say, poor you, and offer him a tissue. But instead, I chew my food.
He finally slices into his steak and pops a strip of medium-rare meat into his mouth.
You and I have vastly different standards of comfort, Sara. Be reasonable.
When I first met Edward, at a soup kitchen of all places, he the volunteer server and me the grateful and very hungry receiver, he wasn't like this, full of self-importance. In fact, I hadn't known he was from money until a month into our relationship, when he took me out to meet his parents for the first time. We spent the night at his family's luxury four-story home, set on an acreage of walled gardens, which reminded me of my favourite childhood novel, The Secret Garden. To say I was wowed by the lifestyle and comfort Edward had been blessed to grow up in would be an understatement. And because I'd been estranged from my mother at the time, and living out of my car, spending my nights keeping warm in the local 24-hour McDonald's, stepping into Edward's beautiful home and into the warm embrace of his mother was heaven-like. So it's not that I don't wish to see his parents or visit their lovely home. Edith and Geoffrey have always been kind towards me and treat me like a daughter. It's just that these weekend stays usually add to the pressure of what is already a highly stressful and sensitive situation Edward and I have found ourselves in. You see, we can't have children. I keep losing them. My body fails to nurture our precious babies beyond the 25-week mark. No matter how many different pills my obstetrician prescribes me, or how well I eat, or how much bed rest I get while pregnant, I always lose my babies. The harsh truth is that I will likely never carry a baby to full term. If you asked me 2 years ago what I thought about it, I'd say I'd be devastated by the fact, and likely still desperately scouring the internet for success stories on forums posted by couples like us, still holding out hope that we would one day be blessed with a noisy family of boisterous kids to raise. But now, considering I was hospitalised after my last loss, I have accepted my fate. Edward has not. Which is odd, because I know that all the trying has exhausted him. He has said as such many times. He has also complained that sex is boring now. Only last weekend he was wistfully recalling the crazy amount of spontaneous sex we used to have in the first couple of years of our relationship. Those wonderful days of countertop sex and car bonnet sex. I told him that we can go back to that. To hell with carefully planned, cycle-dictated intercourse. Let's just go back to enjoying ourselves. Enjoy our coupledom. We are never going to have a child of our own, is what I wanted to say. But couldn't. But here he is, suggesting a weekend at his parents', which he knows is always loaded with questions like,
"So, Sarah, any good news yet?"
from my father-in-law, or looks of disappointment on my mother-in-law's face when I accept a glass of wine or eat a piece of soft cheese. I'm not heartless, though. I do feel bad for Edward's mother, Edith, because I know her yearning for grandchildren comes from an innocent place of love and nurturing deep within her soul. Edward's father, Geoffrey, also seems disappointed that no grandchildren are forthcoming, and although I don't see the same warmth in his eyes as I see in Edith's when discussing the possibility of babies, the lack of grandchildren does seem to bother him. Maybe it's because Edward is their only child and he fears the family line will die with him, which is an understandable reason for his disappointment. But now that I know I'm destined to never have children of my own, I'm starting to direct my focus elsewhere. There are so many underprivileged children out there in need of help, help that we can provide. "I wonder," I say, my cheeks warming at the intensity of my husband's gaze. He hardly looks at me anymore, so it's a little unsettling. "If perhaps one weekend we could both go out and, I don't know, visit those abandoned buildings where the underprivileged kids hang out." Edward is quiet for a few seconds. Then he makes a sound at the back of his throat.
"What? To get knife for my wallet?"
he finally says, drawing his head back theatrically at my suggestion.
"Are you crazy? Where did this come from, anyway?
Why are you even bringing it up?" "I thought we could ask if any of them need our help. Some food, clothing, or maybe we can find proper accommodation, you know, at those safe houses. We have so much," I say, glancing around at the sleek interior of our stunning home. "I think we should share it with those who are not as fortunate as us." My husband raises his brows and curls his lips, making himself look unattractive.
"They'll only want our money for drugs, not for food. Give me a break. Those kids are not underprivileged. They choose to be there, Sarah."
I take a sip of my wine as I regard the sneering man sitting across from me. So different to the kind face smiling down at me as he offered me the comfortingly warm pea and ham soup all those years ago. What happened to the compassionate man I fell in love with? Well, perhaps I'll visit the area myself during the week. There's a van that goes around handing out food and toiletries. Nellie from the coffee shop, her husband runs it. She said they need a new volunteer. Edward's eyes bulge out of his head.
"Over my dead body! You put yourself and our future child's life at risk."
I'm careful not to slam my wine glass against our polished Jarra dining table. "What future child? I'm not pregnant, Eddie." My throat thickens with emotion. "In case you don't remember, I nearly bled to death last time. I trace my finger down the stem of the wine glass as I think about the fifth baby I miscarried, due in October, our little Libra baby. We didn't find out the sex because we didn't want to push our luck. We just wanted our baby, boy or girl, to have a chance at life.
I don't know if I can go through that again,
I say, my voice a hoarse whisper. The loss, the pain, the mental and physical and emotional drain afterwards. As my husband watches me and listens, his face reddens.
What? You think I haven't suffered either?
He says, after a long silence. Spit flies out of his mouth and lands on the edge of my dinner plate.
That was the worst day of my life. I lost my unborn child and I nearly lost you.
I know,
I say, wiping away the dot of spit with my finger. Of course you suffered. We both have. He swallows down something, either anger or sadness. I can't tell. I can never tell lately with Edward. He used to be so readable, back when things were so much better between us. I slide my hand across the table and tentatively touch his fingertips with mine. I don't want you to suffer any more sadness either, Eddie.
Thank you, he says, his words tight and laced with bitterness, for thinking of me.
His phone pings. Then it pings again. Do you need to check that? I say, because I suddenly want this conversation to end. I want to eat my dinner in peace, shower, and then disappear into a good book. Usually, after he gets home from work, my husband takes his phone and disappears into the bathroom or the garage, sometimes for hours on end. Work-related, he always says, by way of explanation. But for all I know, he's having an affair with a colleague and she's burning up his phone with racy messages and nudes. I suppose that would fall into the work-related category. Normally I'm annoyed by it. But right now it's the least of my concerns. Unfortunately, Edward strangely seems less interested by his phone tonight as he ignores the beeps and alluring notifications.
No. I want to continue this conversation, he says,
his knuckles turning white as he makes fists and then stretches his fingers out again and rests them against the table's smooth, shiny surface. Are you okay? I ask, concerned now. You seem so stressed out lately. Is there something you're not telling me? He shakes his head and exhales deeply, then drops his shoulders.
Nothing's wrong, Sara. I need to be around my family. This empty house.
His gaze wanders past me to the wall behind my back, which is adorned with our wedding photos, but sorely lacking the photos of our much-wanted babies, the imagined family we had both wished so hard for. I sigh, slide my wine back towards me, and take a sip. Okay. How about we visit your parents this weekend, but on the way back, we visit my mum for afternoon tea on Sunday. Deal? I want to add that I'll be visiting the underprivileged teens one day in the future, whether he likes it or not, but decide that what he doesn't know won't hurt him for now. He sits and broods for a minute, before he seems to force his face into something closely resembling acceptance.
Okay,
deal, he says. I smile and try to interject a little humour into the dark, intense energy hovering between us. You didn't do it properly, I say, grinning. My husband's face relaxes into a genuine smile, and my stomach flutters. I've forgotten how handsome Edward looks when he's not stressed to the max.
Deal,
he says, holding out his hands in front of him and rubbing his fingers and thumbs together, like the contestants from the old television show used to do.
There. Happy now?
I nod, then giggle. Yes, that's much better. It's as though a magic wand has been waved over us and all the tension between us dissolves. For the first time in months, we enjoy our meal together and discuss plans for a potential trip to Europe sometime later in the year. Then Edward manages to surprise me once again, with two slices of chocolate caramel mousse cake from my favourite cake shop for dessert. We take our wine into the living room afterwards to watch some trashy reality show on the telly together, our thighs touching as we share the same couch, something we haven't done in a long while. But the fun stops when a news flash rolls across the bottom of the television screen.
Body sighted at Lakeland Gardens. Police divers set to begin underwater search and recovery.
My blood runs cold. Lakeland Gardens is a neighbouring suburb to ours, where our best friends Neve and Stan live. This is something I've been fearing for the past 2 weeks, ever since Liv disappeared. I grip Edward's warm hand for comfort. You don't think it's... My husband's face pales. Oh. Oh, God, I hope not.
2. Sara.
Should I call Niamh? Or maybe you should call Stan?
Edward shakes his head.
No, I think we should wait until they reach out to us.
He rubs at the furrows in his brow.
I mean, it's not that they've said it's a teenage girl, and Liv is with friends, isn't she? There's no reason for it, for this body to be her.
You're right. I sigh with relief. It's just a coincidence. This body could be anyone, someone from another area, a guy who got drunk or lost, maybe, then fell into the water and drowned. I say, reassuring myself and my husband with the morbid possibility.
Edward remains pale, his eyes wide, his mind buried somewhere beneath a cloud of dark fears, just like mine.
But, God, if this body, if it's her, they will never recover from this,
Edward says. He covers his mouth.
Oh, gosh. Poor Jakey.
Liv's little brother, Jake, hasn't been the same since Liv left. He refuses to go to football practice because he blames himself for Liv having left while he was at a game. He believes she would never have left home if he had been there to talk her out of it.
But it won't be Liv. Of course it won't be, I say, reaching for a nearby blanket and covering myself with it up to my chin.
If something bad had happened to her after she left, her friends would have contacted Niamh and Stan, surely.
Edward frowns.
But what if she isn't with friends? She could have met someone online, who knows? Some 40-year-old creep posing as a teenager.
Oh, God, don't say that.
I stare at the television in disbelief and wait for the same words to scroll along the bottom of the screen to make sure we haven't read it wrong. But there they are, white letters against a blue banner flying across the base of the screen while a journalist covers a fluff story about an elderly dog who wears a top hat and tails. My heart flutters in panic for Niamh. Even though I've never carried a child full term, I know the pain that the loss of a child brings. And I can only imagine it magnifies after nurturing that child for over 17 years. My phone pings with a message, and Edward and I gasp in unison and both stare at it with wide eyes.
Niamh, I say, before I open the message with trembling fingers.
What did she write?
I read the message, then glance up from my phone, feeling strangely numb. She wants me to go over there tomorrow morning.
Edward's eyes soften with sympathy.
Maybe I should take a day off and be there for Stan, because if it is Liv that they find in the water.
Edward shivers at the thought.
It's weird, Edward, I say, staring at the message in disbelief.
What's weird?
He frowns at me. What she's written is weird.
What do you mean?
He says, not hiding his irritation. Her missing daughter could be floating around in that swamp lake. What part of her wanting you to come over to support her is weird? I thrust my phone at him so that he can read the message for himself. She's invited me over for a champagne brunch. My husband draws his head back at first and takes in what I've said before he leans in to read the message for himself.
What? Does she plan on celebrating?
He shakes his head.
I know Liv has given them hell at times, but she is their daughter.
He frowns.
You're right. It is bloody weird.
I don't even want to go, I say, dropping my phone onto the couch. How can anyone eat or drink while a body is floating around only a few hundred metres away?
Edward gnaws on his thumbnail and shakes his head.
No, you have to go, Soz. You need to be there with her, for support.
Who knows? Maybe this is just a strange reaction. She's wanting to pretend it's not happening.
A horrible dark feeling envelops me, making me shiver. Surely this body is not beautiful, Liv. It can't be. It just
can't. I refuse to believe it.
But what if she is off living with friends like she told them? I say, reassuring myself with the possibility. Teenagers are notorious for leaving home in a huff, aren't they? Then, when they realise how hard life is, they come running back.
Yeah, true,
says Edward. But I can tell by the frown etched deep into his forehead that he's not buying it. I don't think I am either. Liv just isn't that type of teenager. I recall, with a chill, the day Neve called me, sobbing on the phone to tell me that Liv had run away. Liv had left home while Neve was out watching Jake play a game of football. Stan had apparently tried to stop her, but told Neve that no amount of pleading could convince her to stay. I tried too, but my messages were met with a coldness that was unfamiliar to me. With Liv's reply suggesting that she wanted nothing more to do with Edward and me, and that we needed to mind our own business and stop ruining other people's lives. I've always found that odd, her choice of wording, as though she despised us, blamed us for whatever it was that she was going through. It hurt too. We have adored Liv since the day she was born. The feeling seemed mutual too, or so I thought. I can't for the life of me think of anything we may have done to have changed the way she feels about us. Edward's phone pings from the kitchen, and he excuses himself to go check his notifications. The kitchen door, which opens to the garage, shuts, and I know that he's back to his usual routine, his work-related stuff. After I message Neve, telling her that I'll be there tomorrow, I take a shower and lather up with the new lavender-scented body wash I purchased this morning, hoping that it'll relax me enough to be able to sleep tonight. I'm usually fast asleep by the time Edward joins me in bed, after he's spent a good 2 hours doing whatever it is he gets up to in the garage. But tonight, after the news flash across the bottom of the television screen and Neve's bizarre invitation, I don't think I'll be able to sleep at all.
3. Sarah.
I'm woken by Edward calling my name and shaking me by my shoulder.
Sarah, wake up!
He hisses.
What?
I blink several times, wondering why the room is so bright, and ease myself into a sitting position. Edward exhales through his nostrils and takes a bit of time to speak. He's still wearing his pyjama shorts, and his blonde hair is sticking out in all directions. The mattress squeaks when he sits down. It's not until he puts his phone on my lap that I remember why I had such a restless sleep last night. That news flash across the bottom of the television screen. I shiver. Just knowing that a dead body is only a short car ride away from our house turns my blood cold. Edward rubs his face, then clears his throat.
They found the body. Female, between 15 and 25 years of age. No identity yet.
He gestures to his phone, which still rests on my lap. It's all in the article.
Oh my God, Eddie,
I say, reaching out to grab hold of his arm for just a moment.
I know,
he says gravely. I take the phone and read the news story. After I've finished, I notice the time. It's 8:30 a.m. I never sleep beyond 7 a.m, even on a Sunday.
Did you take the day off?
He nods.
Why did you let me sleep in so late?
I turn and swipe my phone off the bedside table. My alarm should have woken me.
I turned it off. You need your rest. Remember what the doctor said.
That was 3 months ago,
I say, unable to hide the irritation in my voice. The time for Edward treating me like I'm a delicate flower is over. The doctor told me to take it easy. He didn't tell me to wrap myself in cotton wool.
Edward shrugs. You're always so wound up. I thought a good rest would help.
Well, I'm done resting, and you know I hate sleeping in. I shake my head.
Of all the mornings,
I mutter to myself, as I toss the covers aside and get out of the bed and head straight for my wardrobe.
I'm sorry,
he says, rising to his feet. Clearly offended, going by the look on his face.
I'm going straight to Neve's,
I say, my throat raspy. Despite the lavender shower gel I use...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?